Good morning, and welcome to Advanced Air Mobility Then and Now at South by Southwest. I'm Diane Gibbons. I advise the innovation arms of the Air and Space Forces, AFWERX and SpaceWorks, and to my right is WASP from AFWERX, Saracena from the Department of Transportation, and Sean from the Federal Aviation Administration.
Hi.
Who here attended a similar session last year? I saw a couple of you. Yes. And so we're building from that, and you know, AAM now and then. Some of you may or may not have seen a space movie where they say, when will then be now? Soon. And so let's just dive into some questions. We already went over some TLAs, three-letter acronyms, FAA, you know what movie I'm talking about, Federal Aviation Administration, DOT, Department of Transportation, eVTOL, we know what that is, AAM, Advanced Air Mobility. And so, you know, WASP, if we could start with you, why does the U.S. military care about getting to market with AAM?
Great question. Thanks for the introductions and allowing us to speak today to the South by Southwest team as well. So it's really interesting to see what not getting to market does in the United States and which countries decide to buy up that technology and not have it available for the U.S. military. So we want to avoid that with the advanced air mobility market. So I've greatly anticipated the commercial launches of the advanced air mobility companies and their commercial products, because what that does is domestically ensures that we have the commercial base, the supply chains necessary for the military to use those products. What getting to market means has changed, I think, for some of the companies, because they're realizing that it's getting a certified aircraft is challenging, extremely challenging. What they need is risk reduction, and my program, Agility Prime, within AFWERX, is helping provide some of that risk reduction, helping them identify what areas of airworthiness have the most risk, what they need to focus on, what is needed to deliver to the FAA for their certification, what's needed to deliver for the Air Force to then reciprocate that certification for future use. And part of getting to market is getting those FAA type certifications. And wherever we can do that risk reduction is where the military is providing value to these companies. So why do we care is really the question. And it's because there's a lot of potential for the vehicles, right? There are many use cases, over 66 different use cases that we initially solicited. And then we've gone into many analytics showing how we would actually do that, and we actually have some big announcements coming up about how we're going to integrate those into actual Air Force units here pretty soon. So part of getting to market is de-risking that certification. And if we can go through AFWERX Agility Prime, de-risk them, have some initial use cases, use some of the first aircraft off of their production lines, also an important part of getting to market, because who wants the first product off a commercial product line? Usually people don't, right? That's the beta product, the one with bugs. You get to discover the things that are wrong with it. But if we can de-risk that with our expertise as well, the military is outstanding at finding workarounds for those initial products, and then as they do the commercial development, launch their commercial product, we can get those upgrades and capabilities as well. So that's some of the main reasons we're interested in this commercial product launch and getting the companies actually getting to market.
Thanks, WASP. And so I have a series of questions for the panelists, and be thinking of questions you want to ask. We'll leave at least, you know, 15 minutes or so to answer questions, and we hope to get all those. If not, we'll stay after a little bit as well. And so, you know, you brought up certification. Sean, I'll ask you about that in a minute. But first, Sarasina, you know, what are key benefits and challenges to the AAM automation strategy subgroup that you determined during the review and examination process this past year? Or anything you want to go into, maybe a brief intro as well.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for having me here at South by Southwest. I first want to say we weren't here last year because, one, for those of you that don't know, this is really, we're all part of, us three, part of the AAM Interagency Working Group. And we actually kicked that off last March in Washington, D.C. And what the AAM Interagency Working Group is we're 22 different federal agencies. And it was a law that was enacted in October of 2022. And really what pushed the law into action is the industry sector. You know, the industry sector, many of the trade associations, GAMA, manufacturer associations, like General Aviation Manufacturers Association, realized that they had enough funding or minimal funding in order to get through, or maybe not enough to get through, the rigorous FAA type certification process because these are new vehicles. So that law forced the Department of Transportation to put together an interagency working group to ensure, or what is needed to scale the operations. So the Air Force has been looking at the vehicles and the vehicle safety and reducing the risk of it going into the airspace and the integration. But what we realize with these vehicles is they are a new type of vehicle, low altitude. They don't fly traditionally from airport to airport in the traditional national airspace system. And the industry from way back from, you know, 2017, the early use cases were around urban air mobility, air taxis, which required new infrastructure. So the scaled operations is what is considered new infrastructure. We didn't have the energy charging infrastructure, the spectrum, all these areas that were not yet in place in order to scale operations. Today, they are getting type certified in the FAA for initial operations, which the National Airspace System is prepared for. But for the future, for high density scaled operations in these communities, and I'll go in communities, in cities, urban areas, that's not what the Department of Transportation is prepared for. And I want to talk a little about the department because I'm with the Office of the Secretary of Transportation, which is over all the modal administrations, like Federal Highway, FAA, MARAD, and how we see the AAM world. It's what we consider an inflection point. It's the first time that we now need to bring in airspace, which was traditionally separate from the other modal administrations, into what's considered a more multimodal integration because it's operating in these higher density, low altitude spaces. So I first want to go there. And the automation strategy group is just one of five subgroups. So as a DOT, I'm the program manager of the automation strategy working group. But we also have Dave Perlman here in the audience who's, managing the community roles. And on my right, FAA, Sean, is over the Air Traffic Federation. And we have two other groups that aren't here, which is WASP is part of the infrastructure group. And there was one other one, I think I already mentioned that. Security, that's right. TSA and all with the mode shift times, TSA and Department of Homeland Security. What I want to mention about the benefits and challenges with AAM automation is some of these companies we've seen there are some within the AAM world that to scale operations they are looking at autonomy in the future, and there's still a lot of work not just from the infrastructure but also there isn't a roadmap and there are, you know, third-party requirements to get to autonomy. We want to first focus on all the safety benefits of automation, which the industry is proposing from, and I'll get to that later. We just put out a white paper on their simplified flight controls that AFWERX is really doing a great job in understanding the risk. I sit under the Highly Automated System Safety Center of Excellence, and in the civilian world, we have a lower risk tolerance than the Department of Defense. We need, as the department in a safety-minded organization with the FAA that has the highest, you know, safety record for air traffic control, we want to ensure that the flying, the public, because these are low altitude, is safe, and that requires a new way of safety, which is a system-wide safety assurance method. We can't just rely on the vehicle automation with the new digital infrastructure that's required for the safety of the autonomous vehicles. Those are some of the challenges that our group is looking at. Anyway, I'm going to turn it over to Sean now. Thank you.
Perfect. And thank you, Sarasina, for clarifying last year. Last year was primarily AFWERX, so there were three of us from AFWERX, and then we had AUVSI as well. So new and additional collaboration there. So thank you for clarifying that. You know, as we continue to discuss safety and innovation and how we can move forward together in that area, you know, Sean's certifications come up twice now. You know, wanted to get your perspective on, you know, considering the nature and complexity of new technologies, how is the FAA approaching the certification process differently?
Well, it's morning, everybody. Really good question. WASP kind of led to it. You know, part of the FAA's mission is certifying airframes. But it's probably a good place to mention that we kind of play two roles in the FAA, different than a lot of other countries do. In the FAA, we're the regulator and the service provider, which means we regulate, we certify aircraft, pilots, we create rules for flight. Everything that happens when you're in the sky, the FAA regulates that. On the service side of it, we're also the air navigation service provider, which means we provide air traffic control service, which means air traffic controllers sitting behind radar scopes, sitting in control towers. In a lot of other countries, those functions are separated. For example, in the United Kingdom, the Civil Aviation Authority holds the regulator role, and they do all the regulatory work, and then they have the National Air Traffic Service, which does the air traffic service piece. The FAA having both is a little unique, and it puts us in a position to where, well, first of all, safety is number one in every area. That's very important. We have, on the regulatory side, we have processes in place for certifying aircraft, certifying flight training schools, pilot training, pilot certificate, all those things we already have rules for. Part of the regulatory structure we have is the ability and the need to sometimes change those rules as technology changes. With advanced air mobility, it's important to point out that it's a very quickly growing industry with a lot of potential benefit to the country. There's a lot of new technologies, not just in the aircraft, but all over that ecosystem that can be brought to bear. Not everything about advanced air mobility is going to be new, though. And sometimes it's important when you have a lot of excitement around something to kind of take a breath and say, what is actually new here? Certifying new aircraft like WASP, that's not new. We do that all the time. You know, even with the electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, we have helicopters that take off and land right now, flying all over the place. They land and take off at heliports. Some of them are on buildings. Some of them are on airports. We have that in the system right now. We have helicopters that take people from Manhattan to JFK Airport. All that happens in the system right now. So not everything is novel. Some of the things that I think that are going to be unique about advanced air mobility is its ability to reach into areas that we typically don't see aviation. And Sarasina touched on this. It's going to be a lot different to potentially see a vertiport built in a community somewhere near a shopping mall, on a parking garage, and give a community access to that type of air transportation where you really can't do that today with a helicopter or a traditional aircraft. So how we integrate those into the airspace is, I think, going to be the larger challenge around advanced air mobility. We're confident that the processes that we have for certifying both the aircraft and all the services and other rules surrounding it are solid, but we do have the ability to adjust and change as needed as we go forward.
Thanks, Sean. And so, Wasp, back to you. And again, we'll head to audience Q&A about 30 minutes or so. Have more questions until then. And, you know, on operations. So getting to profitable operations is a critical milestone, commercial milestone for advanced air mobility. And why is this also important for the U.S. military? You know, we talked about company transitions from designing and building airplanes to operating, sustaining airplanes for profit, and how that's related to the readiness of a manufacturing capability.
I don't know where you get all these great questions, but I'm just kidding. It's very interesting to see the business cases from all the different companies, because some of them are after a few slightly different markets and niches. But from an Air Force and DoD perspective, I also have to present business cases to my leadership, to Air Force leadership. We don't just buy airplanes in the Air Force. We have to have good reasons, goals, requirements, all of these things, and it has to be agreed upon by a fairly large audience, including the joint force, because we don't fight as just an Air Force. We fight as a joint force with the other services. So there's a lot of buy-in and leadership needs that have to happen, and we need to justify the business model, not just the use of the vehicle, but also how much it costs. How are we being responsible for taxpayer dollars in investing in this industry? And I think the commercial launches showing that it is now accessible to more people at lower cost than traditional helicopters is a huge part of that. I hope that we are able to do that in the military a little bit sooner and help justify some of those costs. So for them, for all these companies that are going to build the aircraft and then operate them, that's interesting. And then there's companies that are just going to buy them and operate them as well. So very important for them to prove out those business cases, show profitable business models over time, right? No, I don't think anyone's really anticipating immediate profit from the industry, right? It's going to take some time, and I think investors know that good and well as well. So, but it's great to show the buy down. How is the cost being reduced over time? And that's one of the things we're trying to show in the Agility Prime program, as well as we build business cases for the military. So profitable operations, very, very critical. The business cases that the companies are pushing for, very much needed and desired, and things we need to look at. Because there's likely other additional investments that we need to make as well. And I'll probably jump into that in future conversation here, but
perfect.
Thanks for that question.
Who in the audience is familiar with Agility Prime, by a show of hands? Okay, so maybe we'll explain that. So the Prime program focuses on economic prosperity and national security, priming the pump for these nascent markets. And so Agility Prime really helped move forward advanced air mobility, eVTOL. If you want to share a little more on that, on just the co-investment, risk reduction, and you know, growth there.
Yeah, so there weren't many hands there, so I'll jump into what I'm talking about when I say AFWERX, Agility Prime. So we launched in 2020, so it's been about 4 years now. The industry was right on board with us. This was right at the beginning of COVID, and we launched with all the electronic platforms. So we were able to do one of the first conferences, more or less, via virtual attendance. And that launch really helped accelerate the industry. So we're looking for commercial products and dual use of those products for military applications. The reason for that is 50 to 60 years ago, the DoD was primarily the investor into research and development. And today, industry has a 500% greater investment in research and development funding than the entire federal government. So we need to leverage that investment, that commercial investment. And my numbers are a year old now, but about $14 billion has been invested into advanced air mobility. So we absolutely want to leverage that. How is that applicable to military use cases? How is that applicable to using those investment dollars so that the military and the taxpayer dollars aren't necessarily having to pay down all of that upfront cost as well? So we want to leverage the investment, but do a little bit of financial risk reduction. So we do have money in my program that we can get out to some of these companies if they're showing promise, they're performing, they're providing value to the U.S. government. We can do that, and we have over 26 companies on contract with contracts valued up to $335 million total among those 26 companies. And so what we're doing is really focused around the dual use of commercial products for military uses, and then maybe making the investments in maybe some of the military specific things after the commercial product's been developed and launched and is sustainable. We also want to again encourage that being a domestic supply chain for the U.S. military purposes, so that we're not reliant on foreign powers. And that's really important when you think about how the Air Force has recently reorganized for great power competition.
Yes, and you mentioned the Air Force. We were both Air Force Academy. A classmate of mine is in the audience, Jason, also at the Air Force Thunderbird. And Sean, you started out in the Air Force as well. So go Air Force. But you know, you mentioned innovation and risk reduction. I'm going to mix it up a little bit. You know, Saracene, I'm about to ask you about simplified vehicle operations. But Sean, first, you know, in discussing innovation and regulation, you mentioned how the FAA is the regulator and the service provider. Can you share, you know, how the government is balancing the need to support innovation with the need to ensure safety through regulation?
Another good question. So this is one of the biggest challenges for us, just by the nature of our business, is how do we balance innovation, all the smart people out there that are coming up with new ways to do things, versus the need for us to do things safely. Sometimes I hear a lot of people say, the government's not keeping up with innovation. Well, at the FAA, at the end of the day, our role is safety no matter what, whether we're providing air traffic control services or whether we're certifying an aircraft. As the taxpayers, that's what you all pay us to do. So when you get on an airplane, you're in the sky flying, you're paying us to make sure that it's safe. You don't need to understand how that's done, because that's why you pay us to do it. So in the back of my mind, I sometimes think, well, should we be keeping up with innovation all the time? I think there's a deliberate need to pace that. And I don't know if it's more of a balance that we have to strike, but it's more of a push and pull as things change. And we talked about the dual roles of the FAA, but also we're part of this whole United States federal government. And so the government, just in general, we're there to do things to make society better, make things better for you all. Advanced air mobility can do some of those things, and we know that. So we, inherently as a government, we need to be supporting and encouraging innovation as best we can, because it's going to be good for the people of this country. But we need to do it safely. So that ebbs and flows sometimes. Sometimes industry moves fast, we have to speed up a little bit, and sometimes industry moves too fast, and they need to slow down a little bit. But there is a deliberate push and pull there, and I don't think that needs to change. I think that's the way it should be to some extent. I think it's more of the ebb and flow that we have to work through. It's also important to point out that we're talking about advanced air mobility and all the potential benefits here, but advanced air mobility is going to be integrating into a very, very busy airspace system that's already there. Yesterday, we ran almost 50,000 just instrument operations in the United States, 50,000. That doesn't include all the joyriders flying around and their Cessnas and everything. That's a lot of airplanes. That's a lot of things flying through the sky. We have to not only make sure that advanced air mobility gets on and off the ground safely, we have to make sure that they get up into the sky and interact with all those other missions, all those other airframes that are out there flying at the same time, and do it all safely. So I think it's important to remember that when that push and pull happens, when you hear that industry is moving really fast, well, different industries have different needs. And different, we talked about business cases. You have a lot of companies that have, obviously, they have different investors and different business cases that they're trying to work towards. But our job as civil servants on your behalf is to make sure that we're looking out for everybody's needs. So give us a little slack sometimes when you hear that we're not moving fast enough, because maybe we're not supposed to be moving that fast at sometimes.
Thanks, Sean. We're going to talk a little more about operations, autonomy, and implementation. We're going to sort of transition a little bit into that. And so, Saracena, you know, can you share more on the concept of simplified vehicle operations, SVO, and how the industry is thinking in terms of a stepping stone towards autonomy, or if you want to add anything to what Sean said?
I want to add a little to Sean, and I wanted to get the... the reason I completely 100% agree with Sean that we need to integrate things safely, and I know there's other, you know, sessions here that talk about AVs and integrating AVs separately. The Federal Aviation Administration is different than the Federal Highway Administration and the cities and towns. The FAA controls both the airspace and the certification of the vehicles. In the DOT world, NHTSA controls the vehicle safety of vehicles, and the Federal Highway, regulates the highways. But they actually deliver funding to the cities and states, and those are the people that, you know, have their own infrastructure, have their own and they contract out to infrastructure owner operators for the traffic and lighting systems. What I want to say here is, it's not just safety for innovation. When there's a push technology like autonomy or AVs or AM, there needs to be a level of public trust and acceptance. And where the rubber meets the road, as we're seeing, and Dave is part of that, is we could have the best vehicles in the world, but if you don't have the right public trust and acceptance of these new push technologies, you're going to get backlash. And we saw this right away in San Francisco. So because the government doesn't regulate the cities and states and the states on how they have what's called remote operators and autonomous vehicles, there are certain states that, for example, I live in California, that have different commissions, like the California Public Utility Commission actually regulates public transportation services. So the AVs fell into their regulation. And so these AV companies, such as Waymo and Cruise, were allowed to operate with any real public engagement or public trust or acceptance. And that itself is a risk. So what we saw in San Francisco is, first of all, there's no digital infrastructure for autonomy. So that was one. They're operating in the most congested areas versus the non-congested areas. So it was like a slow train waiting to happen. Well, this was a fast one because, you know, people got killed and things were, you know, cars were set on fire and things like that. So as a civil servant, not just safety, it's public trust and acceptance. And what we know now is a lot of communities, except for the ones that are leaning in and have them there, like where I live is Monterey, where they're being built, you know, Dallas, other cities where there's a lot of public engagement and decisions needed. And not every community would need AM because it competes with their current public transportation system. Like in Boston, you know, it didn't seem necessary from an economic viewpoint to show that. So what we want to do is, part of the IWG, we know that we need a lot more, we need to build the materials for that type of public trust and acceptance and community engagement before this technology comes in place, because we don't want it, what we also saw with the DOT RFI that went out last year when industry went to these bigger metropolitan areas like LA, We had about 100 comments from Los Angeles saying, no need for greed, meaning they just saw this as a for rich transportation mode only. So part of our work with the IWG was, can we first go out with a public benefit use case to show, and this also is autonomy, so that there is a better public acceptance for it? Because in these areas, we don't want burned advanced air mobility vehicles running around or right. So again, as a government, we need to be very cautious from both safety and public trust and acceptance. When we get into these concepts for autonomy, I want to first thank AFWERX for doing a lot of earlier work in the simplified flight controls. But we actually came out with a white paper that's online, what simplified vehicle operations is. And from the innovation side, general aviation has been very inaccessible for most of the population, as you know, whether you have to go through the Air Force to get the flight hours for all that. And these aren't new concepts, like Sean is saying. The F-35 program from the Air Force showed a lot about the unified flight control. What simplified flight controls in SVO is proposing, and they're starting first with general aviation, where 47% of the accidents are a result of simplified flight controls, loss of flight control. And so they're focusing on that. There are three functional categories of pilots. That's the aviate side, communicate, and navigate. So the aviate side is where they're focusing on automating those skills that are most error-prone. And there's a lot of amazing research that AFWERX has done. For example, they took two different eVTOLs, and they took a group of 40, I think it was 80 total, 40 people that were experienced pilots and 40 people that were non-experienced pilots. And they ran them through four flight paths. So they had to, I think it was, take off and land three times, 11 different pilot skills, and one short flight path. So the experienced pilots, it was a joystick that handled automated all these tasks. The I want to say that ab initio group, the ones that didn't know anything about piloting, after their fourth try, fourth flight, were able to have the equivalency of the skills of the very experienced pilot group. So what this showed through simplified flight controls is, they need to meet or exceed the current safety level, meaning the corollary with the surface world is that it's basically when, I learned on a manual transmission, but there aren't many manual transmissions. Now it moves to automatic transmission. There's no backup. There's no manual backup. So it exceeds that safety level of the pilot skills. What we find, or what, AFWERX has found, is that, and because these AM vehicles aren't going to fly those through conventional aircraft, those long routes, there could be 20-minute hops, they're, through the FAA and working with the regulators, there could be, and this is the innovative shift, that we could lower the pilot training from an hours-based competency, hours-based or skills-based, to a competency-based level training. And that's also the economic benefits, because general aviation, to get those number of flight hours, I was one of these people, it takes many flight hours to get your pilot certificate, but this is allowing more people, regular people, to get trained quicker, and that could be, and this is just a, this is just a thought through, more research needs to happen, that there could be more, that the you know, the career of a pilot would be more reachable for more people. So that's the innovative benefit of what this industry is coming out with.
Thank you, Sarasena. And on the, you know, implementation and growth side, you know, Wasp, I think we'll start with you. You know, what is important for the future of AAM growth and, you know, design and powertrains and autonomy stacks?
Growth is definitely the key word there. So advanced air mobility has been the future for a long time. And there's all these designs and capabilities that are going through type certification processes. Well, now we need what's the next rock? What's the next thing? And what we're seeing out of companies is their second generation designs, using what they can from their first designs, their motors, their batteries, their in some cases their original airframes, but maybe a lot of modifications to get to much more advanced capability. Those are the things when I go around to talk to Air Force senior leaders and joint staff leaders. Those are the vehicles that are very eye-catching. The second generation vehicles, they have a lot more capability as far as range, payload are concerned, if you're just looking at kind of the two-dimensional product or attributes. And so those are very critical, and that's kind of the future of growth. And from the military perspective, I need airframes. We need airframes that have more payload capability for sensors, for other upgrades and options that we need, which kind of drives, in my opinion, another push from the AFWERX Agility Prime program for maybe defense subsidiaries of these companies that are pushing out these commercial products. Because we do have laws and rules about exporting military-specific hardware, et cetera, and we may need those defense subsidiaries in these startup companies that don't exist. So we're trying to maybe help and push the industry in that direction. Because if you look at the traditional military defense contractors, they have all of that in place, but a startup company trying to produce a commercial product does not have any of the capability to go after classified facilities where they can engage with us about unique missions or missions that are just at various layers of classification. That requires a defense focus and what we call ITAR or specific military technologies. So if we want to do very simple things, in my opinion, like go out and we have to do identify friend and foe when we fly, especially overseas or in contested environments. So we called that Mode 5 IFF, where it's an encrypted capability to interrogate someone via radar or other means and determine whether or not they're friendly or adversarial or just unknown. And so just a capability to add on something like that to a commercial product, because that's not a commercial requirement. And several things, autonomy is another push from us because it's not necessarily on the initial commercial path. So we need the growth area, we need the capability of the systems on the advanced air mobility aircraft for detect and avoid, for the sensing of the environment so that you can move towards a fully autonomous platform that can engage with the existing airspace and dynamics of see and avoid, commercial and general aviation. So the growth, again, is the push, and there's a lot of technical areas to grow into that may not be on the commercial pathway but are absolutely on the military pathway. We need platforms in this second generation. Even in the first generation, some of that exists. There is room for growth in some of the, so it's the first generation I'm not calling useless. There is use for the first generation aircraft, but I see a whole lot of potential in an exponential growth in generation two, I mean, essentially what we're looking at is the Wright Flyer of this type of vehicle. And to get to the F-35 or the Boeing 737 or whatever other platform we're talking about, that's there was exponential growth. And I think we're going to see that in this industry. And we absolutely want to be a part of that as a military and kind of engaging and pushing some of those specific areas.
Perfect. Thank you for addressing that. And so it sounds like then will be now soon. And you know, back on the, you know, you mentioned dual use, you mentioned military. We'll get back to that. I do want to make sure we have some time for audience Q&A, so we'll get through these questions quickly. Usually have rapid fire, but these may just be a little faster answers. But Sean, you know, how does the AAM Leadership and Coordination Act impact the FAA's implementation?
Thank you. Sarasina mentioned this earlier. Advanced Air Mobility Leadership and Coordination Act required the Department of Transportation to establish the IWG, the working group that we've mentioned a few times, that has now 22 federal agencies all sitting together looking at advanced air mobility. And if you listen to some of the things that are being discussed here on stage, but also think about all the different pieces, if this ecosystem comes to fruition like we think it will, it touches a lot of stuff. You talk about urban transport, you know, metropolitan planning, electrical infrastructure, emergency response, all those things. There are a lot of smart people out there that do those things for a living. They're not all in one place. I'm an air traffic controller, and I'm happy if I can be at the train station on time. I definitely can't plan an urban transport system. But as we go through rulemaking, and as we go through looking at all the things that need to happen in order to enable AAM, the whole of government approach that this act provides is a good thing. We would do this anyway to a certain extent as we go through rulemaking. We coordinate across government agencies, but having everybody in one place, an established forum with some expertise in this specific area, is really going to help to foster that whole of government approach, that every time we're looking at what next steps are, that we're looking at everything from point A to point B. We talk about, you know, it'd be really cool to have a vertiport next to your house. Well, there's a security aspect of that. You know, are you gonna be in the sky just like an airplane? Are you gonna have a TSA guy in your garage? I don't know. You know, those are the things we have to figure out. Having all of the government agencies, or most of them, that regulate those things all in one room to try to figure those things out together can be very helpful, because we can try to align our activities and make things smoother. It also goes back to what I talked about earlier, which is that ebb and flow. We have different, you know, the military, national defense. There might be national defense needs that may drive our needs, supply chain or otherwise, to focus us to move faster in a certain area. We need to know that. And we as the FAA need to know that. And this body of work can help with that. We have the Department of Energy on there. We have Commerce on there. All those needs, looking across society, where the needs are and helping us manage our ebb and flow, I think is definitely going to be helpful as we look at AAM and how it matures.
Thanks, Sean. And so I have one more question each. I'm going to combine for each. And then as you have questions, just start to make your way to the microphone. And in a WASP, we talked about military use cases, dual use. Can you share more on the need to start selling these and presenting current aircraft as the, you know, technical stepping stones to traction for military use cases? You touched on that a little bit if you want to expand on it, but also on the dual use side. You know, you mentioned some of the modifications, IFF, you know, friend or foe, GPS denied, you know, degraded capabilities. Like, what do you want to share more on for this panel before we go to Q&A?
Very quick response to that, and that's, as part of our program, we're tracking manufacturing readiness level and sustainment readiness level of most of the companies that are on our contract. And in doing so, we're able to understand a whole lot better how quickly companies are going to be able to actually get to market and provide changes, modification kits, et cetera, to their platforms. And I think that's a really critical part of the understanding of our ability to move fast in working with these companies and industry for future growth. So that kind of answered, kind of expanded.
Yes, thank you. And so, Sarasena, you know, you touched on some of the economic benefits earlier. Can you share a little more on the barriers or challenges in moving towards higher levels of automation to autonomy? You know, whether it's remote supervised operations of a fleet of AAM, but you know, earlier we were also discussing AI. Can you share a little more about how the Department of Transportation is looking at AI and ML in this domain?
First of all, as far as higher levels of autonomy, and Sean had touched on that. So, as at the Department of Transportation level, we look at it. You know, aviation has traditionally been outside of you know, the roads and the bridges and all that. When we're looking at higher levels of autonomy, there's, and especially in the community, the urban areas, we talk about urban transport, we need that infrastructure for the integration and interoperability, and also the safety aspect of it. And even to get to higher levels of density of these the fleet of AAM vehicles, as you know, some of you guys say, I call it Coruscant. It means that somebody's not going to take this unless that mode shift time is going to cost less than, you know, how long it would take them. So, for example, if you're getting from downtown D.C. to Baltimore or to a suburb outside of D.C. In 20 minutes, but you're waiting for, you know, 30 minutes for your for the first mile, last mile, and it took you probably an hour to drive into town and back. You know, you probably wouldn't think that it's very cost efficient or time savings. So you really need to think about it. So when we're shifting to higher levels of autonomy, the department wants to look at it as a passenger-centric model. You know, the future is for both safety, equity, and sustainability, higher levels of autonomy across all modes is what we look at. And the challenges to that is, it's the first time, as Sean had mentioned, that we are bringing in this aviation infrastructure. It's like the inflection point, meeting that urban planning, you know, transit, and how we integrate and be interoperable and safe. Like I talked about simplified flight controls. Well, when we were in a meeting with one of the security, the Department of Homeland Security, well, you know, if you make them too easy to fly, that's a security risk. And I'm like, why? Well, somebody can just go in there and fly and make it a weapon. And, you know, I didn't think about it that way, but that is a risk, right? And so anyway, it's the balance of security, safety, public acceptance, integration, interoperability that we're all, as a whole of government, trying to understand with a push technology. Now, the biggest push technology of our time is AI, and everybody hears about that. ChatGPT, I think once it came out through Microsoft, had a 90% adoption rate in just a month. And the level of AI adoption and the large language models are increasing exponentially. And I want to say, how the department is looking at this is the same way that all, like the Department of Defense, they're much farther along. So the White House had issued an executive order that all the agencies have to have what's called a chief AI officer. And so we just currently have an appointed one, an acting AI officer, his Vin White, and we're going through the interviews right now. The DOD has, you know, last year they appointed a very seasoned person that's head of their chief digital and AI office. So what it means is at the department level, we have this AI officer, but we don't have it across all the modal administrations, and we need to have a DOT AI assurance framework. So our office, actually, we've hired a couple of AI experts. Actually, one of them is sitting right here, Mubashir Khan, and we also have Dr. Wafeng Yu, who comes out of Boeing. And we had a workshop a couple months ago, across all the modal administrations on what AI assurance is. And there's an AI literacy issue that we found. So the things that you hear about ChatGPT, and that's all generative AI. as far as the Federal Aviation Administration is concerned, that type of AI is not what we are ever going to certify, because from the AI assurance level, we need to be able to, different from the software, we need to be able to assure the models. And there are some that are models like ACAS, Airborne Collision Avoidance System. That is a type of AI model, which is a probabilistic model, but running through simulations, we can get the outcome that we see. So the part of it also is we need to assure the data that goes into the model, but we also need to assure the all the different use cases that AI uses. So it's a big problem, and we need to get industry on board. So we're actually hosting our first DOT AI assurance workshop with industry. I think it's next month. So that is our first one. But again, it's a government industry collaboration on how we bring in AI safely into transportation. So that's how the department is looking at it.
Thanks, Christina. We have just under 10 minutes left. If you have a question, please come up to the mic. As that's happening, Sean, if you want to share, you know, from the public perspective, how will new entrants such as AM be different from the legacy transportation system we have today? And if you have questions, just start to come up.
Well, from the operational perspective, it's definitely going to be different. Most of the differences, I think, are really going to show themselves when things start to scale up. I think initially, as things first start, they're going to integrate quite nicely into the current infrastructure, the way we do things right now. But as scale grows, volume grows, there's going to be a lot of changes. Just as an example, operationally, you know, electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, just they have different aerodynamics than other airplanes. They're going to fly differently, different speeds, different performance characteristics. That's not new in the airspace. We have Cessnas flying around, F-35s flying around. That's not new. What is going to be a little different is when you fly into LAX or DFW or Atlanta, you don't very often see a lot of Cessnas flying around there. Typically, those are at smaller general aviation airports. And what we're seeing with the initial use cases for advanced air mobility is those companies are targeting suburban areas and connecting those suburban areas with large airports and big cities. So that's the, you know, a change that you might see. We don't typically see that level of diversity in operations at our busiest airports. I think on a long-term scale, I think the biggest changes and benefits at the same time are going to be, you know, rural air mobility. You know, the ability for these technologies to provide access and benefit to rural communities that either wouldn't have it right now or would have it a lot slower. Even looking at places like Alaska that have unique geographical needs, Pacific territories, all those different things, I think emergency response, disaster response, those are all really good use cases. And I think there's going to be, from a public perspective, I think those are going to be really where you see something that's right there and tangible as it grows.
Thanks, Sean. And since we have multiple people that want to ask questions, you know, as we transition, if you can say your name, who your question is directed to, WASP, Saracena, Sean. I know WASP prefers three-part questions. I'm just kidding. And in the form of a statement. But if you can ask your questions, we'll try and answer them before the session's over to respect your time. And then we'll also stay after a few minutes to answer any other questions that you may not want to ask in front of everyone. But again, to end on time. Please, over to you.
Sure. Thanks a lot for the nice talk. I would like to ask a question to the Air Force gentleman. I've seen that there are some partnerships with the eVTOL companies with the Air Force, especially like Joby. What exactly is the use case for the Air Force to have an aircraft that has a range of, let's say, a useful range of 100 kilometers or 100 miles? And how do you see the next generation of advanced air mobility propulsion systems in the aircraft for the future?
And we'll have the other question asked, and then we'll just wrap it, if that's okay.
Great question, because use case is always brought up, right? And range, especially, like I said, this is the generation one aircraft, and they're range limited if they're battery only. There are logistics use cases within the military where we're using those types ranges to move smaller parts and people's maintenance teams, et cetera, around. The military also does a significant amount of disaster response. So just doing humanitarian aid and disaster response missions with these vehicles greatly takes a load off of our traditional legacy assets like this CV-22, MV-22 aircraft that have to be then employed for these types of missions. So we're kind of saving our military-specific, very expensive, high-end vehicles for those design points that they were built for, and then using the advanced air mobility for missions like this, right? So there are many short-range missions that these first-generation vehicles can go after. Part two, I think, was focused around the future, right? Very, very interested in expanding those cargo capabilities to ranges that are a little bit more relevant for more theater-wide operations. So if we can do turboelectric generators now that power the battery packs in flight, then we get significantly greater range than the battery packs alone. Hydrogen fuel cells have significantly higher energy density than current battery technology. How do we leverage that for range? So those are the there's even diesel electric that's now applicable to aviation, which was not, these are all developments in the last few years, some of it due to the investment dollars that we're throwing at it, but also the private industry is going after it as well. So there's a lot of benefit to increasing the range payload through the new powertrains, hybrid powertrains. I don't think there was a part three.
All right. Thank you. And we have a couple minutes left, so we'll do one more question, and then we'll stay afterwards for a few minutes as well. Over to you.
It's a very good talk. This is Raju from India. Sharon, question for you. We are a startup. We are involving with the Indian government, with Indian defense. And we started as a small drone company and then converted an eVTOL company, created a platform with 35 kgs. Now we've demonstrated in Himalayas, okay? And now the same technology we want to serve the American, in US, and also serve the rural communities and all. How your department can support us?
I didn't quite understand the last maybe 10 seconds. You can just, did you say rural communities?
Yeah, rural communities.
Okay, so, and your question is basically, as a startup, how can we support you?
Yeah.
So I would say we can support you by educating you and providing you information about where the FAA is at in overall implementation of advanced air mobility, okay. Give kind of what our overall plan is for regulatory structure, where we envision initial activities and things like that. So as these things develop, even if it's not specific to your company's use case, yeah. You'll be able to see how the regulatory process is taking shape and how the planning is changing to help you adjust your plans accordingly. Okay. So I think we have an AAM website at the FAA that has what we call a concept of operations out there. You may have already seen it. That's focused on urban operations. We also have what's called an Innovate 28 implementation plan. And Innovate 28 is like the FAA's brand logo for initial advanced air mobility. We have a plan there that kind of lays out the initial steps we're taking to enable initial operations. I'm sorry.
I can answer some of the research stuff from the DOT on the role.
Oh, okay. Sarasina wants it. Did I help at all?
Yeah, is there any single department? Is there we already got type approval from the Indian government and all. And the same thing, can we use it to get a type approval in US to operate it and sell in US market?
So you know how sometimes they have like.
And we're right at 11, so we can take this offline as well.
It'd probably be easier to talk offline.
Because we also want to mention for rural access and equity, that's a big push from the department. Hmm. So there may be in the future, smart grants and based on different rural communities. The tribal governments are doing a lot with AAM research, especially in the Dallas-Fort Worth area on rural access. So again, that would work with the state and local, governments on doing that. Like if you're here in Texas, Dallas, the Dallas-Fort Worth area is doing a lot of research with rural access.
Okay, thank you so much.
I want to say thank you to the audience. Thank you, Sean, Saracena, WASP, as well, AV team. Enjoy the rest of your time at South by Southwest, and we'll be here for a few more minutes for questions. And please join me in thanking the panel.